from Missouri to New Mexico, Indiana to Washington, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, the United States and China have agreed to phase one of a new trade agreement. But is it a good deal for America? Veronique Dhruge from the Mercatus Center at George Mason University is here with the answer. While all eyes were on impeachment, Congress passed yet another budget-busting omnibus spending bill. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. Some in Congress are proposing tax breaks for the wealthy, but it's not Republicans. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine gets details from Mark Goldwine of the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. And as President Trump heads for an impeachment trial in the Senate, it is important for him to tell his side of the story. So says Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA on this week's American Radio Journal Commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. A ceasefire has taken effect in the trade war between the United States and China as negotiators have reached what is being termed phase one of a trade deal. Here with a look at what that deal includes is Veronique Dhruge. Veronique is a senior fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. Veronique, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Veronique, we have so-called phase one of the U.S.-China trade deal appears to be pretty much set. Can you first of all give us some background as to what is in this particular phase of the trade deal?
It's hard to tell because we have not seen really all of the details of what's in the trade deal, but there are several things we know. First, there is an agreement on principle that China will scale back its practice of requiring IP transfer if you're an American company operating in China. And the other big thing is it's going to be, and that's the one that has the most firm, like that we know the most about, is like we are guaranteed, which doesn't mean very much, that the Chinese are going to be buying a lot of soybeans from the U.S.
In terms of the agricultural products, you mentioned soybeans. Are other agricultural products involved? And does this actually get us back to the levels we were before this whole trade war started?
Yes, there are other farm products involved, and there's also, in response to this first phase, there is the promise of scaling back tariffs, which should help. But it's not going to get us back, unfortunately, to the level beforehand. And even if the Chinese were to commit to this, it's not clear whether they could actually deliver on it because a lot of the supply chains and a lot of the demand has shifted to other markets. So, for instance, like the Chinese have been increasingly buying stuff from Argentina and Brazil. And so it's unclear that they're going to actually stop buying these things and just refocus entirely and go back to the way they were doing things with the U.S. So, especially because the commitment is on soybeans most for the most part, and it's going to take a long time to go back to where we were.
Another major sticking point with the Chinese, Veronique, has been this whole issue of intellectual property rights.
Yeah.
Does this phase of the trade agreement address that issue?
It is agreed on some changes in principle, but I don't know that it has really the ability to make radical changes in the way China operates in China. And a problem is that one of the ways to hold China's feet to the fire when they were violating rules was the use of the WTO. And with the weakening of the WTO that we're seeing right now, it seems that it's actually quite counterproductive because that was the way to hold China to what it had done, it had promised. And in fact, when you look at data from the cases brought before the WTO and China's compliance, at least for external things, the Chinese were doing pretty well. So this is specifically something that takes place inside of China, where it's actually pretty hard to really control them and really kind of force them to make changes. And without the WTO, it's going to be harder. I mean, we still have the WTO, but if the WTO is in question and the president keep rocking the boat with that institution, it's going to be more difficult.
WTO being the World Trade Organization. So taking a look at the agreements thus far, what do you see as the positive points, the benefits to it?
Well, the clear benefits to the agreement on principle is that there is an agreement on principle, and that will be the first step into bringing some certainty into a world where there's actually a lot of uncertainty because of the trade war. So that's a very good thing. I would say that this is the same thing with the new NAFTA, USMCA. Independently of the value of the deal itself, heading towards more certainty is absolutely a step forward. Because, like, so far, investors and farmers trying to sell their products and importers, and they never knew what tariff they were going to be hit with next, and whether, like, the rules they were living by were going to be changed overnight. And so it's a good thing. It's hard to overstate how good a thing it is. And in fact, you just look at the way the markets have responded to this. They're very excited about it.
Where do we go to from here? This is, of course, being billed as phase one. There are going to be ongoing talks. So what happens next?
I think that the next phases are going to have to be to get much more clarity on IP, and not just IP within China, but also IP if Chinese companies are stealing intellectual property and doing industrial espionage, which is something that the president has always said he cares deeply about, and is one of the main reasons for this big war, is going to have to make headways on this. Now, it's going to take some time, and I don't know how much he can get from the Chinese, but I assume that is the next big step. I mean, I'd like to point out something. It's like, I don't see that phase one where the president is getting a commitment from China to deploy its state-owned enterprises to buy more American goods. I don't see how in future phases the president can seriously ask with a straight face that one of the conditions for lowering tariffs on our side be that the Chinese stop using their state-owned enterprises to subsidize investments around the world.
We have been talking with Veronique Darugi, who is Senior Research Fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. Veronique is with us from time to time. And tell us, Veronique, a little bit about the Mercatus Center, also where folks can go to read your writings.
The Mercatus Center is a university-based research center, and you can find all of our writings at mercatus.org. And we have research on all sorts of economic field. We have regulation, taxes, budget, trade, of course, immigration, and cronyism, and all sorts of things.
Veronique Darugi from the Mercatus Center. Veronique, thank you again for being here.
Thank you.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth, actually on Capitol Hill this week, where Congress is getting set to spend a whole boatload of our money. Scott, good to have you here.
Thanks for having me, Lohmann.
Let's explain, first of all, for those who may not have been following the federal budget process, where are we at this particular point in time in that process?
Well, it's been completed this week. What we had was 4 weeks ago, Congress agreed to a four-week continuing resolution that backed lawmakers up against a December 20th deadline. And Club for Growth at the time really cautioned members of Congress against doing this, fearing that it would give the Democrats all the leverage they needed to load up the end of the year spending package with all sorts of goodies for members. And that's exactly what happened this week, Lohmann.
All those goodies got added to the spending bill. I assume that this spending bill, Scott, is breaking spending records once again?
It is. It's spending almost $1.4 trillion. And to put that into context, This is as a result of the Bipartisan Budget Act that your listeners might have heard about earlier this summer. We talked about several times that busts the budget caps on discretionary spending for the final time for 2021 and 2020. And what happened this week was they decided to spend even above and beyond those caps that they agreed upon just this last summer. This legislation also includes a bailout of pension plans for coal miners. And so you could basically equate that as an earmark to those coal mining states. And it includes something that some people are pretty excited about, but I have big concern about, and that's the repeal of three of the major taxes in Obamacare, the medical device tax, the health insurance tax, and the tax on high-cost insurance plans. So the problem here is that when you repeal all the ways that they paid for Obamacare, all it is now doing is putting us one step closer to Medicare for all by having free health insurance through the Obamacare marketplace. I think that this is roughly a $400 billion tax cut over 10 years to those affected by Obamacare, but you really have to think about whether it was appropriate to do that on a spending bill. I think the way that they should have tackled those tax cuts was in a fashion where we repealed the Obamacare spending, those subsidies, and repealed the taxes so that it was revenue neutral. Instead, this is the Democrats' slick way to add another $400 billion to the deficit. And for those of us that are deficit hawks, this is just a big, big concern. We're smack dab in the middle of FY 2020, and that will be a $1 trillion deficit while President Trump is running for reelection.
Looking at this, Scott, obviously the House of Representatives is under control of Democrats. The Senate is under control of Republicans who, at least theoretically, are supposed to be more fiscally conservative. How did we end up with, once again, just like we did last year and the year before, this massive omnibus spending bill? What is with Republicans? They can't even begin to hold the line against all this spending.
I think on one hand, you have to recognize a couple of facts that the House majority is led by Democrats. Elections have results. Speaker Pelosi has the gavel and has a ton of control over her Democratic caucus. And then on the other side of Capitol Hill, Chuck Schumer's got the legislative filibuster. I personally believe the filibuster is a good mechanism to help out the minority. And obviously, conservatives are always in the minority. But that does mean that there needs to be some bipartisan negotiation when it comes to spending packages or anything that's significant in nature. We are in this point today and this week because Republicans lost the 2018 election and Democrats are able to run roughshod against us in getting all the sorts of goodies that they want to see included. They included a 7-year reauthorization of the Export-Import Bank. Alone, that corporate cronyism and corporate welfare legislation would have gotten conservatives all fired up, but this is tucked away as a small provision in over 2,300 pages of legislative text that members had less than 24 hours to review. So the process in Washington is certainly broken, but it's a process that empowers the congressional leadership and certainly those that want to spend more, which means all those appropriators.
So this then brings to an end the 2019-2020 federal budget process?
Yeah, so spending will be taken care of through September 30th of 2020. We'll have another spending fight right before the president's reelection battle. Certainly, if there was any sort of a disaster or emergency situation, Congress can go back to the table and do supplemental appropriation bills. But this legislation that they passed this week will, in essence, take care of federal spending for the entire fiscal year.
Looking ahead then to 2020, as you just pointed out, Scott, presidential election year, every member of the House of Representatives, a third of the Senate, all up for reelection. I suspect that that gives us little hope that we're going to put any control on spending next year as well.
Well, you know, there's obviously some pie in the sky theories that we're going to do budget process reform, and that'll be the way that we actually get our spending under control. I don't buy it, to be honest. I think that this was a wasted opportunity when we had unified government to hold Republicans to account for the promises that they make on the campaign trail when it comes to balancing the federal budget. So really, it's going to take the people to stand up to their members of Congress and call on them to reject this sort of legislating and this sort of appropriating. getting back to a process where we do spend within our means and where we don't overly tax the American people or unfairly tax them. So I'm looking forward to waging that battle. We're at the Club for Growth trying to elect fiscal conservatives that certainly understand the debt and deficit situation. And this week we actually made our sixth endorsement of the year. We endorsed Jeannie Ives in the 6th Congressional District of Illinois. Jeannie has run a small business. She's a mother of five. She was one of the most conservative state representatives in the entire Iowa legislature for the past several years. And she almost beat Republican Bruce Rauner in a Republican primary for the governor's race last year. We're really excited to support her candidacy. And certainly we will be making more endorsements of federal candidates in the weeks ahead.
We will be checking in with Scott Parkinson every week in the year ahead as all these congressional, Senate, and of course the presidential race all unfold. Scott Parkinson of the Club for Growth. And Scott, ending up as always, tell us a bit about the club.
Sure. So the Club for Growth, actually, over the last few weeks, I've talked to our digital team, and we have added over 100,000 members this year. So we are currently at 350,000 members throughout the country from all 50 states. And our membership is united in economic freedom and liberty. If your listeners are interested in supporting the cause for economic opportunity and freedom and liberty, I encourage them to check us out on our website, clubforgrowth.org. Our Twitter handle is @clubforgrowth with the number 4. And I wish everybody a happy holidays and happy new year.
Scott Parkinson of the Club for Growth. Scott, thank you for being here.
Okay, thanks for having me.
Democrats in Congress are seeking to undo some parts of the 2017 tax reform. The result would be a big tax break for wealthier Americans. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine learns more from Mark Goldwine of the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget.
On the campaign trail, Democratic presidential hopefuls are promising huge tax increases, primarily targeting wealthier Americans, to pay for a host of new government spending. But meanwhile, congressional Democrats are set to vote this week to restore a huge tax break that primarily benefits, yes, wealthy Americans. A tax break that effectively shifts the federal tax burden onto middle and lower income earners instead. That tax break is known as the state and local tax deduction, or the SALT deduction, and it does exactly what the name would suggest. Taxpayers are allowed to deduct payments of state and local income and property taxes from their federal taxes. The 2017 federal tax reform, passed by Republicans and signed by President Donald Trump, capped that deduction at just $10,000. But the House is planning to vote this week or next on a Democratic proposal that would lift and eventually repeal the SALT tax deduction cap. And that means potentially giving a huge tax break to people who live in places where their state and local taxes are highest. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is Mark Goldwine. He is a senior vice president at the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, and he joins us now on the phone from Washington, D.C. Mark, thanks for taking some time and joining us today.
Sure. Thank you for having me.
Before we get into what this means for the budget and some of the other budget shenanigans that are going on this week in D.C., Mark, tell us a little bit about what the Democrats are aiming to do with this SALT cap deduction by raising it or by eliminating it.
So the maybe most popular policy right now among many Democrats is to essentially repeal that limit on state and local tax deduction, which would mean that you could deduct unlimited state and local taxes, which in some way is a return to before the 2017 law, but it's actually more generous because prior to 2017, many folks at the top were paying the alternative minimum tax, which actually had no deduction for state and local taxes. So it actually would expand this deduction far beyond what it looked like prior to 2017.
Putting a cap on that deduction, that was one of the bigger elements of the 2017 tax reform. Obviously, the biggest elements were reducing the personal income tax rate, reducing the corporate income tax rate. But once you got past that, this was one of the bigger details in there. How big of a dent does this put in federal revenue if you now, you know, reverse that change and allow people to start claiming these deductions again? What does that mean for federal tax revenue?
It depends on whether it is on a temporary or permanent basis. But, you know, between now and 2026, when many of the tax cuts expire, we're talking about $500 billion. So this is serious money We're talking $50 to $100 billion a year of lost revenue. This was perhaps the biggest pay for in the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. And so if you repealed the SALT cap, the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act would result in even larger revenue losses. Sort of ironically, I think, even larger tax cuts for the very highest earners.
So I guess on one hand, I mean, I like letting people keep more of their own money, right? Raising the cap, getting rid of the cap on this deduction means people who pay high state and local taxes will ultimately get to keep more of their money because they get to deduct that from their federal taxes. Less tax revenue going to the federal government seems like a win to me. On the other hand, when you've got a deficit that's over $1 trillion like we do right now, and you've got $23 trillion in national debt, it does make me wonder if cutting tax revenue is really a solution here, because if you don't cut spending also, you're just making a bigger mess for yourself, right?
That's exactly right. It takes a bill that already is adding to the deficit, that already is delivering a big tax cut to the highest earners, and it transforms it so it adds more to the deficit and offers an even bigger tax cut to high earners.
We are talking with Mark Goldwein. He is a vice president at the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. They're one of the few organizations, honestly, in D.C. that is advocating for reducing the deficit. And I want to get into that here before I let you go, Mark. There's a massive budget bill, $1.7 trillion spending package that is moving through Congress this week. It's kind of been buried because of all the impeachment news, but this is a huge spending bill that will add to the deficit in the long term. And it does virtually nothing, maybe absolutely nothing, to address the debt and deficit issues that are facing the country. I mean, what is the logic right now in D.C. behind all of these things, whether we're talking about the SALT deduction, whether we're talking about this increase in spending? I mean, it seems like on one hand, we're cutting revenues, and on the other hand, we're increasing spending. And I don't get why. Why are we doing this?
Sure. The logic is political. It turns out that tax cuts are popular. People don't want to pay as much as taxes. It turns out that giving people more spending programs and bigger benefits is popular. And it turns out that telling people that we can't afford it all isn't quite as popular. Now, once we actually make those reforms to reduce the deficit, the public does seem to react favorably to them. But meanwhile, politicians they're not thinking about this generation. They're thinking about the next election, and they're just trying to deliver the goodies.
I suppose that is the answer. I mean, that is absolutely the right answer, depressing as it may be. Unfortunately, we are out of time for today. That's Mark Goldwein from the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. Mark, thanks for taking some time and joining us today.
Thanks so much.
And again, you can check out the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget's work online at crfb.org. That's the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. And of course, right now we don't have a very responsible federal budget. You can check out our coverage of the budget, of these tax issues, of the SALT cap deduction that we talked about earlier. All of that at Reason.com. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. Catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal. And have yourself a Merry Christmas.
The upcoming impeachment trial of President Donald Trump in the United States Senate finally provides him with a fair forum to make his case. So says Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA on this American Radio Journal commentary.
Donald Trump has been impeached by the House of Representatives, and soon Speaker Nancy Pelosi will refer the impeachment case to the Senate for trial, a trial whose outcome is near certain. Donald Trump will not be removed from office. If that's the case, then all attention should now be on what kind of trial it will be. And since impeachment is an inherently political process, it's appropriate to look at the trial structure from a political standpoint. What will be the political fallout from the way the trial in the Senate is conducted? There's a short-term and a long-term perspective, and it seems to me that Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell is about to make a colossal mistake by adopting the short-term perspective. McConnell is confident that he can deliver his Republican majority to Trump's side. He has two votes to spare, and even though senators such as Susan Collins, Mitt Romney, and maybe one or two others have been speculated as possible votes to convict, all knowledgeable observers agree that those senators will stay with the majority at the end. With the outcome basically certain, what are the political ramifications of a quick vote possibly by dismissing the House impeachment without even opening a trial, or opening and closing a trial without allowing the House managers to present a case. McConnell, a control freak, if there ever was one, is believed to be leaning towards a very fast process that fits his control model. His world is the Senate. But the issue at stake is of concern to the entire country, and the country will not be satisfied if the matter of impeachment is settled without a trial because the Senate Majority Leader performs a pure power play. It will be seen as an act of arrogance, the arrogance of power. It would be what founder James Madison called the tyranny of the majority. The political fallout from that perception could be widespread. The irony is that it could endanger the very majority in the Senate that Leader McConnell so craves to maintain. The public will see it as a sham trial, and the public does not like sham trials. That's one of the lessons of the House impeachment process. It was a one-sided partisan sham. The Senate should not respond with its own one-sided partisan sham. That's the kind of act that undermines the public's trust in all our government institutions. The negative impact on Democrats that polls have documented as a result of the House's sham will be much greater and much more long-lasting on Republicans if the Senate runs its own partisan sham. Senator Chuck Schumer is a wily partisan with whom I seldom agree, but on this one, that snake has outwitted the Fox McConnell. He has called for a minimum of 4 witnesses, every one of whom is a Trump appointee. McConnell should respond with a full battalion of witnesses, including a cadre that can convincingly expose the corruption of Hunter Biden's dealings in both Ukraine and China. This will be a huge benefit to the president's credibility and will help all Republicans by extension. Joe Biden's willfully blind-eyed Hunter's corruption that comes out in a trial will hurt the elder Biden much more than the original investigation proposed by Giuliani and Trump. Trump will thus be more thoroughly vindicated than if he simply gets a quickie no vote on impeachment. If you're unconvinced that this will be so, acquaint yourselves with some of Peter Schweitzer's writings in the Wall Street Journal. The average voter is completely uninformed on what Schweitzer has exposed and thus falls back on simple partisan identification. A full trial will truly educate the public, and it will also satisfy their need to see the process as just. And there's more out there than just Peter Schweitzer's work. As loyal listeners to American Radio Journal, I urge you to contact your senators, regardless of party, and write letters to the editor of your local newspapers, and write on blogs and other online news sources demanding a full and fair trial with both sides calling witnesses in the Senate. This has been Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring for American Radio Journal. Visit us on the web at letfreedomringusa.com.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WRYV-FM in Milroy, Pennsylvania, WGFP-AM in Webster, Massachusetts, along with FortWorthBeachRadio.com in Fort Worth, Florida. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. All of us at American Radio Journal extend our best wishes to you for a blessed Christmas season. Happy holidays from American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.